This week on the Best of Flashpoints, Greg Pallas talks about the Exxon Valdez spill 20 years after it devastated Williams Sound and destroyed indigenous life and culture. Also, founder of the Electronic Intifada, Ali Abunima, gives a post-mortem on Gaza and talks about the possibilities for justice and freedom for Palestine. And Malik Rahim of Common Ground talks about the violence of poverty and injustice in the United States. I'm Nora Barrows-Friedman with Dennis Bernstein. All this straight ahead on the Best of Flashpoints. Stay tuned.
And you're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. My name is Dennis Bernstein. It's been 20 years since the Exxon Valdez went aground in Alaska, devastating 1,200 miles or more of Alaska's pristine coastline with toxic oil. Quote, it also marks the 20th year of a lie, writes Greg Pallast on gregpallast.com. Quote, lots of lies. Greg Pallast is one of the key investigators over 18 years ago working with the indigenous population to hold Exxon accountable, but it wasn't to be. And 20 years later, the devastation of the spill is still being felt, and Exxon has been virtually let off the hook. Joining us to talk about Exxon and give us an update on Wall Street meltdown bailout is Greg Pallast. He's the author, among other things, of Armed Madhouse and the editor of gregpallast.com. He reports for the BBC. Greg, it is good to have you back with us.
Always, Dennis. Always glad to be with you.
Well, let's shoot back to the beginning. Right up top there, Exxon Valdez said the first thing was it wasn't going to be a big problem because the good weather and good conditions essentially wiped the spill away.
Oh, yeah. Mother Nature took care of it all. According to the lazy reporters who don't go up to the Prince William Sound to look at the oil. If they did, kick over rocks over near Chinega on Sleepy Bay, and it still smells like a gas station. It's 20 years later, man. The damage is still there. Mother Nature doesn't wipe your poop for you so easily, especially with the geology of Alaska. And the evil crime, it's kind of ecological Holocaust denial. Exxon just says it doesn't exist. Mother Nature cleaned it up. That's it. If you go to gregpallast.com, you'll in fact see masses of oil cleanup being done by guys in yellow suits. Those are natives, local natives cleaning up their beaches in hazmat suits. Those pictures were taken 7 years after the spill by my BBC crew. But Exxon just said no more cleanups after 7 years just because they didn't want the PR and figured no one would care anymore. What, the governor of Alaska, Sarah Palin, is going to care about what happens to the natives there? She won't even accept unemployment insurance compensation from the federal government, let alone trying to do something for the people who live in the sludge today.
Let's talk about how bad it was then, why it was so bad and got a lot worse based on Exxon's lack of action and preparedness, and what the devastation is that continues.
Well, first of all, let's start out with their lies. I mean, one of the big stories that always comes out is that there's a captain, a guy named Hazelwood, who is drunk, and he ran the boat onto a reef, kind of like a drunk driver at the wheel. That's just complete baloney, Dennis. He was stewed. So was the first mate and the second mate. But they were below deck, sleeping it off, when the third mate was at the helm. But he's flying the boat, this giant tanker, without the Raycast radar system. Raycast was like the early version of GPS, where you could see even a three-year-old could have taken the tanker through the Valdez Narrows if the radar was on. But it was, at that time, wasn't a $200 GPS. Those things at that time cost millions to build and to operate, train. So Exxon, after the maiden voyage of the ship, it didn't work, so they kept it off and turned it off, which is against the law, by the way. It's like having, no speedometer or something. And so that's why the ship hit the reef. Even then, however, I should note that would not have caused the disaster that we saw. The disaster was caused not only by Exxon's cheaping out on the radar, but even more, by saving millions and millions, even billions of dollars on safety equipment to contain contain a spill. Tankers hit reefs, they run aground, they spring leaks all the time, Dennis, unfortunately. But that doesn't mean that you end up, you know, sludging and sliming 1,000 miles of coastline. What you do, it's real simple. You put a rubber boom, like a, just a big rubber skirt around the ship and its oil, and then you suck it out with a pump into another ship. Well, Exxon promised that they're going to run the water route, which they didn't have to do. If they're going to take oil by water, that they would leave this rubber skirts, these rubber booms, out all over the Sound, including right at the place where they hit Bligh Reef, you know, named after Captain Bligh. They were actually supposed to keep equipment right there at the native village, and where if a tanker ever hit there, they could just surround it with the rubber skirt. So it should have been nothing. But there was no rubber skirt there, and there was no ship to suck out the extra stuff that's called a containment ship, because Exxon, despite saying they would never run a tanker without the containment vessel nearby, they ran it anyway, even though the containment vessel was out of commission. It was in a dry dock, and the stuff was locked under ice, the pumps. So you had no radar. Once a ship hit, they had no rubber to contain the oil, which is simple stuff, but, you know, they didn't do it because they figured, well, who's going to check for equipment out in the Prince William Sound except natives, right? They didn't have the ship ready to go, the emergency containment ship. And so you added those things together. Plus, and I got to tell you, that's your disaster, but even worse. And here's the ugly, ugly thing, Dennis. It was a crime. And I don't mean that. That's not a metaphor. Before I was a journalist, I was a racketeering investigator. This is criminal activity. I'm not kidding. I use that advisedly. In April 1988, according to my investigation, you know, it's a team. I'll give credit to many people on this. We found memos 10 months before the spill, in which Exxon and the oil company chiefs, their chief guy in Alaska, a guy named Theodore Polasek, wrote the chief of Exxon and the chief of British Petroleum, which is their partner, Arco Petroleum, part of British Petroleum, and said, we don't have the equipment that we need that's basically required by law in case there's a spill on the Prince William Sound. And Arco said, well, then, if that's the law, they're British. They say, okay, well, I guess you got to comply. And Exxon vetoed it. Exxon adamantly vetoed spending the money to put out equipment required by law. So what their guys did is they simply signed papers saying the equipment was there. This was the top guys. This was, you're talking the presidents and CEOs of the oil companies meeting in Arizona, April 1988, 10 months before the spill, saying, forget it, we're not going to have any spill equipment up there. 10 months later, the spill happened. That's like has racketeering conspiracy written all over it, Dennis. All over it.
We're speaking with Greg Palast. We're talking about the 20th anniversary, if you will, of the Exxon Valdez spill in Alaska that destroyed hundreds of miles of the Alaska coastline and really went a long way to destroy a way of life, Greg. I guess tomorrow's the 20th anniversary. People are still being devastated and undermined by this action. Who was hurt? Tell us about the people you met and who was hurt on this kind of spill and who is still being hurt.
I actually worked for the Chugach Native Alaskans who, this is native land. It's their islands and their beaches that were destroyed. But you have to understand, it wasn't just, you're not talking about Malibu, where there was, by the way, a spill. We're not talking about G or Summer House. These people have lived there for 3,000 years. They're the last people in America to actually survive off the land and where they live. And they lived off seal. They lived off clams that they got, deer, et cetera. It was all poisoned, destroyed. The seals were, of course, poisoned and died. One native elder, Henry McCarka, was telling me about an otter who he watched an otter just with burning his eyes, bring a hive kite and gouge out its own burning eyes. The deer would eat the poison vegetation and die. Eagles were dying because they were eating the poisoned salmon. It was devastation. And when The president of Exxon came for a photo op to the village saying, we're going to take care of everything. Paul Komkoff, a native seal hunter, said, you know, I'm hungry. You guys are dropping McDonald's foods from helicopters. What is that? I mean, where's my seal meat? So they sent in canned seal meat, which was marked not fit for human consumption because it was zoo food. And, you know, these villages have never recovered because the poison was there for years and years and years. Some of the natives were also commercial fishermen. And, of course, who wants, you know, 90-octane salmon? So they went bankrupt. They lost their boats. And Exxon has refused to pay after 20 years. And there was a court judgment against them, $5 billion, which was supposed to go to 30,000 people. And the Supreme Court this past year, the Bush court, John Roberts, said, well, you know, why are you picking on Exxon, and cut it by 90%? So now, after 20 years, people are getting finally their checks, 10 cents on the dollar. So welcome to corporate America. And the president of Exxon, by the way, retired, that was in charge of this fraud, really, received a $400 million bonus on his retirement. I mean, that everyone's shaking about AIG. That's twice of all the AIG bonuses combined.
And this treachery by Exxon was premeditated and quite conscious in terms of its brutality all the way through.
Yeah, I mean, you have to understand. It's not they said, oh, let's have a spill. What they said is, we can save. See, that's the whole thing. This is a profit center. To maintain spill equipment, emergency response teams. They used to hire the natives to go with the tankers because they knew the waters, and they were trained to deal with spills. They had a lot of technical expertise. They knew the waters. They fired all the natives. They got rid of the equipment. They didn't have the containment barges. They refused to have double-hulled boats, which would have also prevented the damage. They saved billions. They saved billions. And when they even had, they would lobby their way out of laws like double-hulled tankers. But even when the law said, they made promises under oath, the top guys at Exxon and British Petroleum and its ARCO unit swore. You're talking about the chairman and CEOs and presidents swore to Congress under oath that they would have spill equipment, that they would maintain the state-of-the-art radar. That was under oath. And they had state-of-the-art radar, but it was off. You know, so yes, it was. What was premeditated was the penny pinching, or billions of pennies, of course, billions of penny pinching operations, which led to the disaster. And they didn't care because it was like, to them, it's the cost. What they ultimately paid, now this 10 cents on the dollar payoff, that's like a license to pollute. As far as they're concerned, it's a license to pollute. If after 20 years, hey, we pay a few bucks. They even told me, Otto Harrison, and I want you to remember his name because I like to name these people. It's not just an empty corporation. General manager of Exxon USA said, hey, you know, we'll outlive you. And they did. Paul Komkoff, the seal hunter, is dead. What's the point of giving him a check now?
Outlive them, huh? Outlive the victim and celebrate your retirement on the backs of entire communities. It does sound like corporate life as usual. Is there any way, is there anything to do, or is this now, as they say, dirty water under the bridge?
Well, a couple things. One, Mr. Obama, he got maneuvered into agreeing to some new offshore drilling, expanded offshore drilling during the McCain-Palin oil panic. You know, drill, baby, drill. Okay, and Obama said, okay, well, we'll open up some more coastal waters to drilling, supposedly because we have new safeguards. Well, we heard about those safeguards before the Exxon Valdez. All the safeguards were there. That they lie. They still lie. I mean, I just came back from Ecuador, where Chevron Texaco's pooped all over the Amazon. Please just look at Louisiana. I mean, my God, you know, I mean, yeah, they know how to prevent oil spills. They know how to prevent oil pollution, just that it costs money, and they're not going to spend it ever. Forget it. It won't happen. You know, and they'll never enforce the law, because the other aspect of this, and this is not a side issue, you know, as a senator, Obama was... was a supporter of so-called tort reform, you know, preventing people from filing class action lawsuits, the evil lawyers. Well, you know, I got those documents. I have to tell you, I got those documents about the secret meeting of Exxon and the other oil chiefs before the spill through the legal process, through the Natives lawsuit. They were seeking justice. They were seeking compensation, and we forced Exxon to open its files. And, you know, yeah, we didn't get the money for the Natives that they deserved, but that we got a lot of the truth. And that's only because of the right to sue, the right to bring class actions. And I'm just afraid that last route of justice is being shut down by corporate America. And I'm just afraid that Obama is going to give into this crap, as he did as a senator, that evil lawyers are filing too many lawsuits against corporations. That's nonsense. There's not enough.
All right. We're going to leave it right there, Greg Palast. Greg Palast, GregPalast.com. With BBC, the best money democracy can buy. That's still the big problem in this system. Greg, as always, a pleasure to have you with us. And whenever you're in town, please look us up.
You got it, Dennis. And go to GregPalast.com, and we're going to have a new film out, Palast Investigates, with the BBC films, the BBC reports, which will be launching next week, the BBC reports that you're not allowed to see on U.S. TV. And you'd know these stories.
Well, we're looking
and so I really appreciate the platform you've given us. Thanks, Dennis.
Thank you very much, Greg, for the great information. Appreciate it.
In Berkeley, I'm Nora Barrows-Friedman. You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. We continue our focus on the unraveling situation inside occupied Palestine. As the U.S.-supported and armed Israeli massacres in Gaza took place earlier this year, as the Israeli elections resulted in the installation of extreme hardline right-wing Zionists to the Israeli Knesset, and as the acceleration of home demolitions and land theft takes place every day in the West Bank, Palestine once again suffers under the weight of crushing injustice and occupation. That's all the more reason to invite onto this program the voices and analysis of those who keep eyes and ears tied to the ground, providing the international civil society with context, background, and motivation to keep us all working for justice and freedom for Palestine. Today, that voice belongs to Ali Abonima, here with us live in the Flashpoint studio. Ali is the co-founder of the electronicintifada.net and is the author of the book One Country, A Bold Proposal to End the Israeli-Palestinian Impasse. Electronicintifada.net is the web's most important site for information and analysis on Palestine, Iraq, Lebanon, and the greater Middle East. Ali, it's so great to have you back with us on Flashpoints.
Thank you. It's wonderful to be in the studio with you face to face.
Well, I think Rashid Khalidi, the historian, said that what happened in Palestine in 1948 was the greatest armed robbery in modern history. And Gaza is one more crime scene that we can add to that list. Let's talk about the aftermath of the Gaza massacres first. The humanitarian, the social, and the political ramifications of what Israel did to Gaza, supported by the U.S., you know, 1,400 Palestinians killed, 450 of them children, thousands wounded. Talk about where we're at right now in terms of Gaza.
Well, you're right to use the word crime scene because it's literally a crime scene. And you recall that during the Israeli assault from December 27th to January 18th, Israel banned journalists from entering the Gaza Strip. It's very clear now why they did that, because despite the efforts to censor and suppress what happened, the incontrovertible evidence of massive war crimes, as Richard Falk, the UN special rapporteur, called it in his report yesterday, that what happened in Gaza would seem to constitute a war crime of the greatest magnitude under international law. And the evidence is coming out from multiple sources. There have been reports now by Amnesty International, Human Rights Watch, of course, the UN Special Rapporteur, the UN Human Rights Representative on Children in Armed Conflict, the National Lawyers Guild delegation that went, numerous other independent observers, the Palestinian human rights groups, and so on. But most shockingly or sensationally in the last few days, the testimonies of Israeli soldiers themselves. And I think it kind of shows some of the underlying racism that the war crimes that you have been talking about on your show, we've been reporting on the Electronic Intifada for months, do not get mainstream attention until the perpetrators themselves start to talk about them. The victims are not believed. And this is pretty typical. I mean, if you think of, you know, how we see crimes treated in our own society, very often women who are victims of sexual assault are not believed. You know, because they are disempowered, and so it is here. But also, I think what has emerged is the massive evidence of the complicity of the United States. The Amnesty report, in particular, which documented in detail the types of weapons used by Israel, produced and sent by the United States, which, according to Amnesty, were found in hospitals, in private homes, in school playgrounds, all over the Gaza Strip. And to me, this is something that's just as important, the complicity of the United States government in perpetrating these crimes and in helping to cover them up.
Well, let's talk about the international legal body's responsibility of holding these war criminals accountable, and not just the Israeli officials who ordered these attacks and these massacres, but the United States corporations and the governmental, alliance with the Israeli military and its government. What can you say about, the International Criminal Court, the United Nations? What is being done right now in international civil society to really take Israel to task and hold them accountable?
We're at a very crucial moment because we're going to learn now whether these international institutions really do what it says on the tin, whether they are really going to uphold international law, human rights standards, the Geneva Conventions, and do that for all human beings and to treat all human beings with equal dignity, or whether they are simply going to be weapons that the strong use against the weak, that the victors use against the defeated. It's one thing for the courts to be used against Charles Taylor in Liberia or against Omar al-Bashir in Sudan or against Slobodan Milosevic. The question is, can these same weapons of justice be used against perpetrators that are armed, backed, and supported by the United States and its allies? And that's what we're going to find out. And it's a real split, because what we see now is people of integrity within these institutions, people like Richard Falk, a respected professor emeritus at Princeton, world expert on human rights and international law, giving a legal report to the UN Human Rights Council. We have Radhika Kumaraswamy giving a report on children in armed conflict again. We have groups like Amnesty, as I mentioned. And what's the response of the Obama administration? It was yesterday the spokesman for the Clinton State Department, Robert Woods, dismissed the report of Richard Falk, the special rapporteur, using exactly the same language as the Israeli government, saying that Falk is biased. So launching an ad hominem attack on a respected UN-appointed official rather than dealing with the substance of the accusations, dismissing it. So, I mean, what we see, unfortunately, from the Obama administration is precisely the same policy as the Bush administration when it comes to Palestine. But the test there really, I think, is for international civil society, whether we're going to let them get away with this. One of the encouraging things is the use of universal jurisdiction. The ICC, go back to that, the International Criminal Court. The problem with that, the way it was set up so that it couldn't be used impartially. States that are not signatories are beyond its jurisdiction unless the Security Council refers a case to them. So even though Sudan is not a signatory, the reason the president of Sudan was indicted is because the Security Council asked the ICC to investigate. Now, of course, with the Security Council, with the U.S. and its other allies wielding a pro-Israel veto, there's almost no chance the ICC is going to investigate despite the massive evidence. But you have groups like the Palestinian Center for Human Rights, assisted by some other international NGOs, who've gone to the courts in Spain. The Spanish courts have agreed to investigate. And you see Israeli officials now getting very nervous about getting on planes and traveling to other countries because they face the real risk of a Pinochet situation where they might find themselves under arrest. So it's tremendously important that the grassroots effort to use and support the use of universal jurisdiction continue and boycott, divestment, and sanctions, because that's what's ultimately going to put pressure on governments to hold these people accountable. And here in this country, where we have such an enormous responsibility, look at the situation where Hillary Clinton goes to Sharm el-Sheikh to that summit, allegedly, about giving aid to Gaza. And she says the United States is going to pledge $900 million on condition that the Palestinians do what we want. You know, Hillary, when you give humanitarian aid and you attach political strings to it, it's not humanitarian aid, it's blackmail. So we have Palestinians who are living amidst the rubble in tents for the third, fourth, fifth, tenth time in their lives in Gaza, without clean water, without medicine, without food, nursing the wounds from the horrifying weapons used by Israel and sent by the United States. And they're being told the humanitarian aid is conditioned on you doing our bidding politically, supporting the puppet leaders we choose for you, recognizing in Israel, and so on. And yet, the $30 billion that the Obama administration has pledged to send to Israel in military aid over the next decade is totally unconditional. I am sure that if we were to have an open debate about that in this country, the vast majority of people in this country would be utterly horrified and outraged that medicine for children, cement and bricks to rebuild homes and schools is conditioned, but the F-16s, the bombs, the flechette weapons, the phosphorus bombs, all made in the United States, is sent to Israel unconditionally, despite the massive evidence staring us in the face of the, to quote Richard Falk, war crime of the greatest magnitude.
That's the voice of our good friend Ali Abu Nima. He is the co-founder and editor of electronicintifada.net. And he's in town tonight in Palo Alto at 7:30 p.m. at the Fellowship Hall, First Presbyterian Church. Tomorrow night, back in Berkeley, for an event benefiting Middle East Children's Alliance at the First Congregational Church, 2345 Channing Way at 7. Ali, let's talk now about the West Bank, the acceleration of colonization by settlement activity, settler violence, home demolitions, violence against peaceful demonstrators by settlers and the Israeli military. Again, we have Hillary Clinton saying that the settlement expansion is, quote, unhelpful. What, you know, given the timing of the new Israeli Knesset with Avigdor Lieberman, a self-described ethnic cleanser who lives in a settlement colony inside the occupied West Bank, about to be confirmed most likely as the foreign minister in the Knesset, you know, today we saw more settlers coming into Umm al-Fahim across the Green Line, chanting death to Arabs. Give us a sense of kind of the mood on the ground in the West Bank and how that's spilling over into the Green Line and kind of what's happening there, how you see that playing out.
Well, some people are very upset that Avigdor Lieberman, the leader of this racist party in Israel, will be the foreign minister. I'm actually very happy because I think it's truth in labeling. Avigdor Lieberman today is the true face of Israel and of the people, in the sense that the vast majority of the Israeli public say they support the policies, and to the extent they opposed what happened in Gaza, they opposed it because they thought that not enough violence was perpetrated.
82%
yes,
said that it was.
Yes. And something like more than 90% among Jewish citizens of Israel. Of course, the 1.5 million Palestinian citizens of Israel were overwhelmingly opposed to what happened. I mean, yes, the acceleration of colonization in the West Bank is proceeding apace. Just in the past couple of weeks, the occupation municipality in Jerusalem confirmed its intention to demolish the homes of 1,500 Palestinians in occupied East Jerusalem in an area called Silwan, in order to cleanse them from the area, in order to establish a Jewish-themed park in East Jerusalem. So this is the continued religiously, racially motivated assault on the physical and cultural presence of Palestinians in Jerusalem. And another event that got almost no coverage in the past few days is Palestinians attempted to hold cultural festivities in occupied East Jerusalem, celebrating Arab culture in the largest Palestinian city in Palestine. And there were all kinds of cultural activities planned in schools throughout East Jerusalem. Israeli police, armed police, paramilitary police, actually went in to the Ambassador Hotel in occupied East Jerusalem, to the Schmidt School, to all the schools, confiscated flags and balloons and literature, cultural literature, shut those things down, arrested people, and banned these cultural celebrations. I would like to know what the reaction would have been if armed paramilitary troops had done that to a Jewish community somewhere in the world, if the Chinese had done it to Tibetans. There would have been a worldwide outcry. But this is going on in occupied East Jerusalem, where Palestinians are not even permitted to celebrate their own culture, their own language, their own art in their own largest city. They are met with the most brutal response from armed thugs of the Israeli state. So this is the situation across the West Bank. Israel has announced in the past few months the construction of thousands of more Jewish-only homes in the settlements. And we're told, actually, that the West Bank is the, you know, in the U.S., an Israeli approach to the West Bank and Gaza, that there's a carrot and stick, that the Palestinians are being deliberately starved and blockaded and punished in Gaza for making the mistake of democratically electing the representatives that they wanted. Whereas the West Bank is supposed to be the shining example. And that's what's going on there. You have mass arrests going on. Just last week, the Israeli occupation forces kidnapped 10 Palestinian members of parliament and academics, including a former deputy prime minister and minister of education, Nasser al-Sha'ir. These were all democratically elected representatives, simply kidnapped and picked up. And they now presumably join the 40 or so other democratically elected members of the Palestinian Legislative Council who were kidnapped by Israel after their election in 2006. And we have total silence about this from the United States. In fact, total support for it. I wouldn't say silence, which is why it is urgent that we see a broad-based, and we are seeing, but it needs more support, a broad-based boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement, exactly as we did in this country with the anti-apartheid movement, because there's no other force for accountability.
And I want to talk more about BDS in one moment, but let's get back to that word, that idea of democracy and the democratic process, because you know, here in the States, in Jewish communities and you know, in other communities across this country, we hear that, you know, Israel is the only democracy in the Middle East, that, you know, Palestinians inside the state enjoy civil rights that are not found anywhere else in the region. You know, today, as we saw what was happening in Umm al-Fahim, the Israeli police commissioner of that area said that he was protecting democracy, basically protecting the democratic rights of those settlers who were chanting death to Arabs inside a predominantly Palestinian town. How is democracy protected? I mean, has democracy lost all of its meaning?
Well, you know, democracy in Israel has always meant the right of Jews to dominate Palestinians, and that's all it has ever meant. And so we have this march by the settler thugs from Hebron, led by Baruch Mazel, who has carried out incitement and attacks on Palestinians for years, including violence against them. And what we see now is the militant West Bank settler movement taking the tactics that it developed in the West Bank and turning them against Palestinian communities inside Israel. So we saw that late last year in Acre, in Acre, in the north, where you had settler thugs basically carrying out a pogrom against Palestinians in the city. You've seen it in Jaffa, where settlers are moving in. Jaffa, of course, is a Palestinian town on the coastline south of Tel Aviv. Most of its Palestinian residents were ethnically cleansed in 1948, but there is a Palestinian population that survives there. They now face a threat from these settler thugs. And you have these settlers from the West Bank now marching through Palestinian cities like Umm al-Fahm in Israel. And we're being told, on the one hand, cultural celebrations in children's schools in East Jerusalem are being shut down by armed paramilitaries. Those same armed paramilitaries are actually protecting these racists as they march through Arab towns. It's very similar for some of your listeners who are familiar with the situation in Northern Ireland in the past, when you had these bigoted Orange Order marches being forced through Catholic areas, through nationalist areas, and the police would protect these marches and suppress the residents whose right to safety, whose right not to be abused by bigots, whose right not to be harassed was being violated. So Israel is following very much that line. But whereas the rest of the world has moved on and I think is moving to a more enlightened place, Israel seems to be devolving to a form of thuggish, ethnic, tribal hatred that is uniting the whole society and making anything permissible. I mean, the other shocking story that came out in the past few days is of the T-shirts. That, you know, the Israelis also tell us, in addition to we are the only democracy, they also say we have the most moral army. And I think now, you know, many people around the world have seen the images of the T-shirts that are being openly sold in the streets and being created by Israeli soldiers after Gaza, of showing, celebrating the killing of Palestinian children. The one particular T-shirt of showing a pregnant Palestinian woman with a bullseye on her belly and the slogan saying, "One shot, two kills." Just in the plane, I was reading about the T-shirt, which has had a picture of a Palestinian mother screaming as her baby is lying shot on the floor with the teddy bear next to it and with the bullseye over, again, celebrating this kind of killing. And reading a real story in one of the testimonies from one of the National Lawyers Guild delegates of a father who watched his little girl being shot and the teddy bear she was carrying being covered in her blood. And yet these are things to joke about and celebrate in the state of Israel today.
Hmm. Again, that's the voice of Ali Abonima here with us in the Flashpoint studio. Let's talk about the global BDS movement, boycott, divestment, sanctions. It was such a momentous and wide-ranging movement in the 90s to finally bring down South African apartheid. Mm. People say now that globalization has kind of come in between a realistic approach to BDS now, that it's really hard to kind of extricate Israeli products from activism, and you know, capitalism has kind of played a role in that. What do you say to people who don't think that BDS is an appropriate way to hold Israel accountable for its crimes?
I'd say they're mistaken, and I'd like to explain why. BDS stands for boycott, divestment, and sanctions. So those are three strands of a strategy, but each is slightly different. The boycott includes not just boycott of Israeli goods, but boycott of Israeli universities and cultural institutions. And we saw recently the Bat Sheva dance company, an Israeli-sponsored dance company, touring the United States. And I think in almost every city they went to, they were confronted by Palestine solidarity activists in very creative ways, protesting and having a presence and challenging those who'd come as an audience to confront the morality of sitting there, enjoying beautiful dance while this slaughter is going on in Gaza. And the slaughter continues, by the way. It's not by any means over. Just the other day, there was an article in the New York Times which quoted an Israeli foreign ministry spokesman, Arieh Meckel, saying that the Israeli government was going to allocate millions more to send artists, novelists, dance companies, theater companies around the world to improve Israel's image. So if Israel is actively using cultural production and artists as part of its state propaganda effort to cover up the crimes in Gaza and to try and clean up Israel's image, it is perfectly appropriate and necessary to respond to that with protest and boycott. Divestment, we saw the Hampshire College, which was the first in 1977 to divest from South Africa, being the first to divest from companies doing business or selling arms to Israel, a great success. I think to put this in context, when I was in college, the anti-apartheid movement was at its height and it was very mainstream. Over the past few years, people have said to me, look, it'll never get to that stage with Israel. It's just too difficult. There's too much support. And I think we're seeing every day how wrong that analysis is. And the first, it took from the Sharpeville massacre in 1960 until the 1980s, so several decades, for the anti-apartheid movement to become mainstream in the United States. We've gone from 2005, the first Palestinian national call for boycott, divestment, and sanctions, to 2009, where we're already reaching that level of consciousness, if not in the United States, certainly in Europe. I mean, what could be more inspiring than South African dock workers refusing to unload Israeli ships, just as dock workers around the world refused to unload South African ships during the time of apartheid. We've seen transport workers in Norway go on strike in solidarity for people in Gaza. We've seen, actions all over the world, trade unions, universities. We've seen in dozens of universities around the world, particularly in the UK, students occupying buildings and making demands of their administrations to divest, to halt collaborations with Israeli universities, which are so complicit in the occupation and the violence. And this movement is growing apace. It's very, it has a long tradition in this country. The Montgomery bus boycott was a boycott. Nobody says it's discriminatory against white-owned bus companies for them to have had that boycott. Everyone understood that this is a form of nonviolent resistance, of mass mobilization, that it is used to further the aims of universal justice, and that it is powerful, that it holds not just Israel to account, but it's a way to hold our own politicians to account. And we want to get to a point where they did with the South Africa anti-apartheid campaign, where no member of Congress, no mayor, no state governor feels comfortable opposing this movement, where it becomes so mainstream, so rooted in the universal values that we espouse as a society, that everyone supports it. And I'm confident we're going to get there. I've been traveling all over the place, and I am so inspired by the activism I'm seeing.
Ah, well, What else inspires you? What keeps you going? I mean, it's very easy to become extremely cynical and frustrated and suffer outrage burnout. You know, to use our president's own words, hope and change, do you feel that those are applicable using BDS, using all the tools that we have as civil society at our disposal? Will justice and freedom come to Palestine in our lifetimes?
Yes, they will. Yes, they absolutely will. I'm convinced of that. And, you know, we can sometimes complain that the Israelis have every advantage. They have unconditional support from the United States and many other governments. They have, you know, as a first world country, the means of communication, the military means, you know, an unchallenged military. And it has done them no good in terms of securing the legitimacy of the colonizing project they've been engaged in Palestine. And I think there is enormous strength in a moral cause. And the Palestinian cause is a moral cause. It is a just cause. It's a cause for freedom that is related to, that draws strength from past struggles for freedom in South Africa, in Vietnam, the civil rights movement in this country, in Northern Ireland, in so many places around the world. It's the same. It's a continuation of that struggle. It is the last piece of unfinished business in the struggle against Western colonialism in the Third World. And the thing that inspires me is that in so many of those other places, it has been possible to get past it, that victims, those who have lost so much, have a tremendous capacity to be creative, to build a future, to be inclusive. And I have enormous confidence in Palestinians that they can do that. And every single day, I think more people are recognizing this. I think the cause of supporting Israeli colonialism, Israeli violence, Israeli domination is running on inertia right now. It's running on accumulated strength and power, but that power is not being regenerated. It is being gradually whittled away. And what we've seen is that things can change quite unexpectedly in history. The most remembered events are those that no one saw coming. And so the possibility for enormous change in our lifetimes exists.
All right. Well, we're going to leave it right there. That's the voice of Ali Abunima, co-founder and editor of the electronic intifada.net and the author of One Country, A Bold Proposal to End the Israeli-Palestinian Impasse. Ali, as always, it's so good to see you in person and to have you here on Flashpoints.
Thank you.
And you're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. My name is Dennis Bernstein, speaking with Malik Rahim of Common Ground. Now, Malik, I wanted to, and we were talking about police power and police abuse at a direct, overt level where you've got a force willing to kill the community it's supposed to protect. And there's another kind of police power. And it has to do with the federal government using agents and infiltrators to undermine people doing good work, such as the work that you do on Common Ground. And I've been wanting to ask you about this. We don't have a ton of time, but it's very important. And it's the other side of the story of East Oakland. Your organization, Common Ground, was heavily infiltrated by a now self-admitted FBI informant infiltrator named Brandon Darby. He was on this show at least twice. Mm-hmm. Now, when we talk about, you know, being infiltrated, mm-hmm. could you imagine that somebody could actually be working inside KPFA that could also be working for the federal government? Oh, Dennis, you're paranoid. No, well, paranoia is unjustifiable fear. We have righteous fear about what the federal government is willing to do to undermine good work. Tell us about Brandon Darby.
Well, again, Brandon Darby was one of the co-founders of Common Ground, you know. And he wasn't only a paid informant, but he also was a paid provocateur. know, many people wind up leaving Common Ground in disgust because of their interaction with Brandon. My own son left in disgust because of Brandon. So again, and it shows that...
How did he do that? How did he provoke?
My son just told me, he said, Dad, something is wrong with him. Something is wrong with him. He's doing, you know, every time there's chaos, he is in it. Every time you turn around, he's trying to get up to you to be too close to you, something is wrong. My son was so convinced that he was an agent that he went and searched his possession to find out something that he could show me to convince me that this man was an agent. But the last thing I can understand the government coming in to watch to see what we are doing. You know, maybe they could learn. But to come in to destroy, I never thought it would be illegal to serve people in the aftermath of a major disaster. I never thought that would be illegal in America. But then again, we're talking about the same nation that after the same disaster decided that a certain race of people could not find refuge in certain parts of America. So when we lead this, then everything come about. When you look at the fact that we allow the Patriot Act to exist, and without trying to, it should be a mass movement to repeal it, because it takes away all of our constitutional rights. Then, and when you look at the fact that the same thing happened in the aftermath during the Civil War in Chicago. You know, so it's not the first time. So it always have it. But how can you ever say in America, you know, that there is not a Brandon Darby? Because he is everywhere. He's everywhere that people stand up for peace and justice. There's a Brandon Darby. And it's sad that this have to happen in America. It is sad that this young man, you know, a young man that I loved, you know, had to turn to such dastardly deeds, and not for patriotism, because he was a paid informer. He did this for 30 pieces of silver, and there's many of them that is out here. There are not, I mean, he was just one that we found out in Common Ground.
Did he?
But they don't work alone. They don't work alone. And if this, and then when you look at what happened to us, who was the Brandon Darby in the People Hurricane Relief Fund? Who was the Brandon Darby in the other grassroots movements that was trying to establish not only in New Orleans but throughout the Gulf Coast region in the aftermath of Katrina? So it wasn't just him.
But we do know it was him, the Brandon Darby, who was in police state of St. Paul during Republican convention, where the police were even getting involved in torture, among other things, with the support of the Republican National Committee. And there he was. I'm wondering which journalist I know.
Yes. I mean, it was the same one that was also in New Orleans when we was protesting what they was doing to residents in public housing. All of a sudden, this fictitious flyer emerged saying that for every unit of public housing that is demolished, one unit of condos is going to be burned down. It is the same pattern.
All right, now let's go. So in terms of being a provocateur, let's talk about that. So he provided a leaflet that suggested that there would be violence, a violent response to a particular building structure.
Yes, at least in that.
Did he do that more than once?
That fly emerged then. No, but I'll tell you what else he did. He created havoc at the largest housing component that we had at St. Mary's.
How did that happen?
He started spreading an allegation that the priest that was there, Father Bart, was a pedophile. Then he started bringing in crack addicts and others to create an atmosphere of distrust, until eventually we had to close the place down.
What was so dangerous to the government that they needed this action disrupted? How do you explain that?
Well, in the aftermath of Katrina, to be critical of FEMA and FEMA lack of response. It was also to take upon the wrath of Homeland Security. And when he took upon the wrath of Homeland Security, it went back to doing his most dastardly deeds, COINTELPRO Katrina style. And Brandon Darby was directly in the mix. But then he was not working alone. He was not working alone. And that's the sad part of it. That's the sad part of it. That if you are critical of this government response, is this free speech? That you have a Brandon Darby? That you have him to sit around and not as to spy, but to destroy? You know, I mean, it makes you look at, you know, across your shoulder at everything.
So, and it's that old sort of COINTELPRO.
That's what
you know,
it is.
Play, you know, play both ends to the middle, disrupt, and suggest violence that the community is engaged or planning to engage in violence. And this is now a self-proclaimed agent of the government of the United States, who, again, my brothers and sisters, was in St. Paul, where the police violence and every level of security force was there, and where we saw, you know, the implementation of the Patriot Act at the local and state level there. And there's still terrorism trials going on as a result of probably his infiltration. But we have a minute left. But this dialogue that we have, Malik Rahim, is ongoing. And it continues. And we're going to, I made you a promise before we went on the air that we're going to figure out a way to bring flashpoints down to the lower Ninth Ward. And we're going to do a week or two of broadcasting from your neck of the woods.
Well, why don't you look at between August the 29th and September the 9th?
Well, okay, we'll look at the schedule.
You know, that's the time that not only will be the 4th year anniversary of Katrina, but also the 4th anniversary of Common Ground Relief and Common Ground Health Clinic.
We'd love to do that. Okay. Malik Rahim, as always, we appreciate having you with us.
It's always an honor.
Very enlightening. We want to hear more and more about Common Ground and know about your multiple struggles to help the people in your community, despite the police state that we have to deal with. People don't like me to say that. I get lectured every time they say that, but yes, it depends who you are. For some people, this is definitely a police state. That's it for Flashpoints.
Thank you.
And that wraps it up for another edition of Flashpoints, which airs every weekday and is produced by Dennis Bernstein and Nora Barrows Friedman. Our contributing producer is Robert Knight, and our technical director is Eric Klein. Our Friday co-host is Francisco Herrera, Miguel Molina is our roving producer, and JR and the Block Report contribute to this program. To comment on today's program, please contact us at dbernstein@igc.org. Look us up on the web at www.flashpoints.net for our archive shows. Dozens of affiliate stations across the country broadcast Flashpoints on a regular basis. Please email us your call letters and Flashpoints broadcast schedule at dbernstein@igc.org, and we'll add you to our website. Many thanks to our web team, and thank you for listening.